Let's begin with our motivation. So having an awareness that the nature of our mind, the ultimate nature of our mind, the empty nature of our mind, is the exact same nature as the ultimate nature of the Buddhist mind, both empty of true existence. And so in that way, our mind is just like the Buddha's mind. It's not that our mind is inherently existent and the Buddha's mind isn't, or that we have to change the mode of existence of our mind to get enlightened. That's not the case at all. So because we have that natural Buddha nature, it said we have the basic Dharmakaya right now that gives us the potential to become fully awakened. If the nature of our mind existed inherently, then the afflictions would be part of the nature of our mind. The mind would be permanent, change would be impossible, as would Buddhahood. But because the ultimate nature, the mode of existence of the mind, lacks true existence, then ignorance can be overcome by the perception of reality that knows things as they are, that they're empty. So having this basic Dharmakaya, and also having on the conventional level the nature of the mind being clarity and awareness, having many virtuous mental factors, and knowing that although these are covered by stains, by defilements, by afflictions, these defilements are adventitious. They aren't the nature in, they aren't the, have entered into the nature of the conventional mind. So, again, they can be eliminated, especially by generating the wisdom that perceives the opposite of what ignorance perceives, and thus can cut off the continuum of ignorance. And when ignorance ceases, then the affliction ceases, then the karma causing rebirth ceases, then all the dukkha, the misery of cyclic existence, ceases. So let's feel happy that we have this basic Dharmakaya mind, that the afflictions are adventitious, that an antidote exists to overcome them, that there's countless beings who have come before us who have overcome the afflictions and have overcome the cognitive obscurations as well and become fully awakened Buddhas. So if we have that basic Dharmakaya, we have knowledge of the path, we have a precious human life, and we've met the Dharma and have teachers to guide us, then compared to most other living beings in samsara, it's like awakening is just around the corner for us. So while it takes persistent effort, it's definitely possible, and we can feel really joyful about our opportunity. And so let's do that and come to practice with an enthusiastic mind that believes in our own potential. Thank you. So we have been going through Aryadeva's 400 stanzas, the yogic deeds of bodhisattvas, and we're on each, there are 16 chapters. Each chapter has 25 stanzas, 25 verses. We're on the sixth chapter now, which is called Eliminating Afflictions. And so if we want to, or put it this way, since we want to become Buddhas for the benefit of all beings, then in order to fulfill that, we have to counteract and eliminate our own afflictions because they stand in the way. You know, something is obscuring our mind, standing in the way of us actualizing our most heartfelt wish, then we have to overcome those obscurations, those obstacles. And so this chapter is dealing specifically with the three main obstacles of ignorance, anger, and clinging attachment. So we've been going through those in this chapter, and the Buddha's been giving advice about how to overcome each one of them, you know, and also how a spiritual master guides disciples with a preponderance of one over the other, you know, because how people are guided depends on, you know, their dispositions, their makeup, and so, you know, kind of, although everybody receives the same teachings, the personal guidance might be a little bit different. Yeah, somebody has more attachment, they're treated one way. If somebody has more anger, they can be treated another way. Yeah, so it's skillful means. Okay, so we're on verse 138, and here this verse is about the means of caring for a person who is very habituated to desire. So we're all habituated with desire. Here, desire is referring to clinging attachment, you know, to the mind that exaggerates the good qualities of someone or something and then holds to it, clings to it, okay, wants to possess it, doesn't want to be separated from it. Okay, so how, so we have this figure called Joe Blow in English. In Tibetan, he's called Kachik, which means one mouth. So... Yeah. So Joe Blow asks, how do you train somebody in whom desire is a strong habit? Good question. How many of you, is desire a strong habit? Yeah? Okay. So the Aryadeva says, Buddha told those with desire that food, clothes, and dwellings are all to be avoided and to remain close to their spiritual guides. Okay, so a person with a lot of desire, you know, I think they're kind of implying here that this person is a monastic because they're only mentioning food, clothes, and dwellings, which, you know, monastics have four requisites, food, clothes, dwellings, and medicine, you know. So they don't mention computers and cars and your Costco card and your bicycle and your sporting equipment and your pass to the disco and your iPad and, you know, your all your music that you download and everything like that, your season's tickets to the Dodger games, you know. Okay, so the Buddha here is focusing just food, clothing, and dwellings. Yeah, are all to be avoided. So it doesn't mean, you know, totally avoided, but it means that things that a person with desire would see as attractive and develop a lot of attachment for and desire for, they should not come in contact with those things. Yeah, because the mind just has so much attachment that it goes for those things right away. It's difficult to develop self-control and restraint. Okay? So the Buddha told them to avoid, you know, beautiful objects. So fine food, very beautiful, luxurious clothes, expensive dwellings, soft beds, you know, your favorite blankie, you know, all the things that we get attached to. And, you know, by having that separation from those things, then that gives you some mental space to do your practice and, you know, to recognize impermanence and the unsatisfactory nature of these things, the selfless nature of these things. And by developing that wisdom, then to cut the continuity of the afflictions. Okay? So one part of it is to, you know, for people with desire, to not be near their objects of desire. And the second is for them to remain close to their spiritual mentor. Okay? Why is that? Because people with desire, their mind goes here, their mind goes there, they want this, they want that, I want to travel here, I want to go there and have that, I want to experience this. You know, their minds, I mean, you know what it's like. Yeah, I just want to go around and have a good time. I want to go out and have fun. Yeah. So if they remain close to their spiritual master, then they have to settle down a bit. You know, they can't just go here and there and do what they want when they want to do it. And so that also helps them settle their mind by not having so much attachment to, you know, so much contact with objects of attachment. And also their spiritual mentor will make them work constantly. Yeah, this is the instructions for people with desire, that you make them work constantly and that curbs their desire, you know. You keep them busy doing Dharma work so they don't have time to daydream and they don't have time to run here and there and chase this and that. Yeah, and you make them work very hard because, no, seriously. I mean, you guys are laughing, but it's, you know.
We're not laughing. We are so not laughing.
Okay, the Sangha's not laughing. Yeah. Yeah. So it, you know, it makes you kind of stay focused on the Dharma and stay focused on accumulating merit and on serving sentient beings instead of just going around and having a good time all the time. Okay? And then also, you know, that way they'll receive teachings, especially teachings on the three higher trainings of ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. And if they put those teachings into practice, then it can help them really cut the root of their clinging and of their desire. Okay? And so, you know, because when they apply those teachings, then they start noticing, you know, how am I perceiving something? How am I reacting to different things? And they begin to see the inappropriate attention in the mind. You know, inappropriate attention is a mental factor that it looks at something and it exaggerates its good qualities or projects good qualities or exaggerates its bad qualities or projects bad qualities. Yeah, so we pay attention to things, but in an inappropriate way. Yeah, and so then the mind kind of dreams up all these stories and, you know, what you want to do and who you want to be with and how you're going to live happily ever after. But if somebody with desire is, you know, living close to their spiritual mentor and their activities are getting reined in and they're doing, their mentor's making sure they're doing a lot of meditation on these things, then, you know, they'll be able to overcome their afflictions. Okay, especially the affliction that misconceives reality or misapprehends reality. Okay, so at the time of the Buddha, and still now to some extent in some Buddhist traditions more than others, the people with a lot of attachment are taught 12 kinds of training. It's called Dutanga. Yes, the Pali or Sanskrit word, the Dutanga. For there are 12 kinds of trainings that the Buddha prescribed for people with a lot of attachment. Okay? So regarding shelter, first of all, they should live in a secluded place. Yeah? Not in the middle of a lot of commotion, in a place with a lot of finery. They live beneath trees, or in graveyards, or in a roofless place. Okay? So that's especially for men. Women aren't allowed to stay outdoors. Yeah, the Buddha thought that was too dangerous. Well, let the men freeze outside. It's okay. No, the Buddha had the nuns, they lived closer in to towns and so on, because they thought it would, and they lived together in a community. The Buddha thought that was safer for nuns. Okay? But anyway, I mean, that you still can live in a way that's very simple, you know, without a lot of possessions, a lot of stuff. Okay, so you don't need the most modern this and that, the most beautiful this and that. You just, you know, in your accommodation, you just have what is needed to do your practice and not what isn't needed. Okay, so really focus on simplicity. Okay, in terms of mattresses, yeah, for the Dutanga practice or for sleeping, you're supposed to sleep cross-legged, sitting up, not lying down. Okay? Or if you have a mattress, then it's grass. So it's not a, what is it, Sili Posturepedic, you know, kind of the really, yeah. But, you know, it's amazing how attached we are to our mattresses. No? If your bed's too soft, you complain your back hurts. If your bed's too hard, you complain your back hurts. You know? Right? Yeah? I'm sure some of you are complaining even being here. You know, we all... I mean, it's amazing kind of how much people spend to buy a bed. And then all we do is sleep on it. We aren't even awake to enjoy it. You know, because when you're awake, you get out of the bed. Yeah. So isn't it amazing? When you're asleep and you're totally unconscious, that's called enjoying your bed. It's true, though, isn't it? You know, when you awake, you don't, you know, and you feel, well, you don't want to lie in bed all day. It's like, get me out of here. Okay, then in terms of food, then they eat alms. In other words, you don't go out and buy your own food and cook your own food. And, gee, I feel like eating this today, so I'll go buy this and I'll go cook that. You know, nothing like that, but you go for alms. Yeah. So in Thailand, even now, you know, they will go around on alms round and people will give them food. We can't do that here. We're a bit too isolated. So we do it in the sense of saying that we don't eat food that's not offered to us, and people offer it. And then whatever we have, we use and we cook with it, you know. And if you want to make something and you don't have that ingredient, then you just don't make that thing, or you make it without that ingredient, or whatever it is. You know, you just use whatever is offered. Another part of the Dutanga practices was to eat one meal a day. Or if you're going on alms round, you can only go to three doors and collect food, and you only ate what you know, people at three households gave you, not any more. Okay? And you only eat what you receive, like on the first alms round. You don't go back and kind of, you know, go around again to get some more. In terms of clothes, then, you know, it was very difficult at the time of the Buddha, actually, for the Sangha to get cloth to make clothes. So sometimes the lay people would donate cloth, But very often they had to go to charnel grounds and get the cloth, the shrouds. Yeah, the shrouds that cover the dead bodies, or pick up some cloth by the side of the road, something like that. So you wear rags. So you stitch together these things. That's why you see many patches in our robes. So you're supposed to use cloth that either other people have used for over 4 months, or cloth that's been discarded. Yeah, and that way you don't get attached to having really nice robes and so on. Yeah, I always tease people. You can tell the people who are newly ordained usually because the maroon color of everything is the same, you know. For the rest of us, then, you know, everything's a different color of maroon. We only have three robes. So the lower robe here, this robe, and then for the fully ordained people, we have another robe that is made of many, many small patches. So you're only allowed to call those three robes your own. Even if you have duplicates of them, because you need to wash your original ones, you don't consider your duplicate ones your own clothes. You consider them as something that you're sharing. You're sharing it with somebody else, or you're going to give it to somebody else. Yeah, and so we aren't allowed to accumulate a lot of clothes. Yeah, check up when you go home. One body. How many shirts, how many pairs of pants, how many shoes, how many coats? It's really amazing, you know. And yet it's so hard for us to give things up. Really hard. Yet we, you know, how much can you wear at one time? So I'm gonna make a little pitch here, because the Abbey is involved in Newport. We have a nonprofit organization called Youth Emergency Services, and it's to help the homeless teens in our county. And even though we come from this podunk county in the middle of nowhere, you know, there's over 100 homeless teens in our small place. It's really outrageous. And so we try and keep them in school, and we give them backpacks with school supplies at the beginning of every year. And then now it's like the weather is changing, so we need to get them coats and boots for the winter, you know. And we do things to, we employ one social worker, and she helps find them homes to live in, because they used to be living under the bridge when you go into Newport, the bridge over the Pendaray River, so the kids were living under there. So if you have jackets, warm clothes, rain gear, boots, yeah, please give it to us, and then we'll take it in. Also warm socks, clean socks, and underwear for both men and women. I mean, this is what the kids always need, and so we'd be happy to take it in and give it to them. Or if you can't bear to part with, you know, one of the 500 things you have, you know, and would prefer to make a donation for their clothes and their, you know, their boots and things, then we can take that in. Because the Abbey has, you know, we have a position on the board of Youth Emergency Services, so we do what we can. Okay, and then for monastics, only felt clothes. So I guess felt at the time of the Buddha was a very coarse material, you know, not something real comfortable. So not wearing expensive materials that are kind of soft and luxurious and smooth and everything like that. We should really keep our dress simple, yeah, and keep everything about what we're doing simple. Okay, but people who are very habituated with anger, you don't make them do these kind of austerity things, the Dutanga, because they have so much anger that when they're uncomfortable, they just get angry, and then they can't meditate. Yeah. So for people who are angry, you go a little bit easy on these kinds of things, and then help them to do their practice so that they, you know, they really need to work on their anger and, you know, and also, of course, on their attachment, okay? But the people with a lot of attachment, those are the ones that you, you know, you really emphasize this kind of thing. So we also have a thing at the Abbey that every year people change rooms. So that way you don't get attached to a room, and that way every year you have to carry your junk from one place to the next. And it hopefully motivates you to get rid of some of it. Okay. Then, verse 139. So this is, this starts the extensive explanation on how to abandon anger. And so we start by talking about the disadvantages of anger. So verse 139, Aryadeva says, through anger, those who are powerless only make themselves look ugly. But one who has power and is merciless is said to be the worst. Okay? So if you don't have power, you know, somebody else has more authority than you, or it's a situation really where you can't do much, but you get angry, yeah, then, you know, our face turns, you know, our brows knit and our face turns red and we really begin to look rather ugly and our voice gets kind of like that and it doesn't do any good at all. Yeah. Or even if it's not a relationship where somebody has power over you, but even with somebody who's equal, you know, when we get angry, we don't look very pleasant, do we? Yeah. So that's why they say that actually anger creates the karmic cause to be very unattractive in our future lifetimes. Because you can see by being angry in this lifetime, we're unattractive. So it creates that cause, you know, to be unattractive in a future lifetime. And so we may get angry and complain and yell and scream and, you know, does it really help? Because I think most of the time, you know, when we're angry, it's because we're wanting something or we're needing something. But instead of kind of checking up with ourselves, what am I wanting, what am I needing, what am I expecting, and seeing if it's something reasonable or not, or seeing how to meet our own needs or releasing the attachment to what we're wanting, instead of doing that, we just blame others and get angry. Yeah? And what does it do? You know, maybe you get so angry that people are afraid of you and they give you what you want. And many people mistake that for respect. Yeah, but it's actually, it's not respect, it's fear. People don't respect you when you're a tyrant. They fear you. So, so to avoid that anger, and then here he's also saying that the merciless anger of somebody who has power and who can inflict a lot of harm because they have power is the worst anger of all, because those people damage themselves and damage others. Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many examples of this in the world, isn't it? You know, people who are angry. And that's why, you know, you look at what Martin Luther King did and how astonishing it was, and what Gandhiji did, you know, and just astonishing. And they were successful. Yeah. They didn't get angry and yell and scream and kill people. Yeah. But, you know, they held to their values and principles and didn't let up. And they were very successful, as opposed to people who, you know, pull out the guns and start fighting and killing others and so on and so forth. It's quite interesting, different societies, what we consider our patriots. Yeah? Because, for example, when I was in Israel and they were taking me around, we went to one place that used to be like a British prison where they incarcerated a lot of the Zionists who wanted freedom from Britain and wanted to have their own country. And, you know, these people were regarded in Israel as patriots, and they had statues of them and everything at this place. And I was going around, and I commented, I read what some of them had done, and I said to one of my friends, "Oh, they're not patriots, they're terrorists." And my friend, "No! They're patriots, you know." But if you look, even our own country, I mean, look at the Tea Party, the old one, you know, from the 18th century. Yeah? Wasn't throwing all that tea out of the boat? Isn't that a terrorist activity? Yeah? And yet there are American patriots. So it's quite interesting what people consider patriots and you know, are often what other people consider terrorists. Yeah. Of course, it depends a lot who wins the war. Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, like the Syrian opposition right now, you could call them patriots, you could call them terrorists. It depends which side you're on. Yeah. But the best of all is not to have anger and go around damaging other people and inflicting pain and creating the cause for oneself to be reborn in hellish realms. Yeah, best is that. Okay, then verse 140 is talking about the inappropriateness of anger in circumstances that terminate the effects of misdeeds. Okay, so in circumstances that terminate the effects of misdeeds, in other words, that use up our negative karma, our destructive karma, then it's inappropriate to get angry in situations that consume our negative karma. Okay, so Aryadeva says, "It is said unpleasant words and previously done ill deeds. The ignorant and unwise do not want to purify themselves." Okay, so what this means is it's said that unpleasant words end the previously done ill deeds. Okay, so when we hear unpleasant words, this is a result of our having used harsh words and unpleasant words on others sometime this life, usually previous lives. Okay? If we're beaten, it's because we harmed others physically in the past. Yeah? If we are treated rudely and inconsiderately, it's because we treated other people like in that way sometime in the past. Okay? So this is the whole idea of karma, the boomerang effect, you know. New Age says what goes around comes around. But, you know, it's the idea that the energy you put out in the world is the energy you experience back, you know, in your own life. So when we have unpleasant situations, yeah, if we're a Dharma practitioner, we should regard those unpleasant situations as the ripening of our own negative karma. If we regard them in that way, then we're actually purifying our negative karma. Okay. However, if when we have, you know, troublesome circumstances or experience suffering, if we instead get angry, then we completely blow that opportunity to purify. And instead, we create more negative karma by getting angry. Okay? So let's say somebody comes and, you know, accuses me of doing some awful thing. If I just say to myself, okay, that's, you know, that's the ripening effect of my having given false accusations and said harsh words to other people, so I'm not going to get angry. You know, I still need to explain myself and clarify the situation. I don't just accept a false accusation, but I don't need to get angry at it. you know, and I don't need to instantly go into defensive mode and take out, you know, my 100 million excuses, and excuse me, my 100 million explanations. You know, but I can remain calm. But if instead I get angry and I start going, "Who are you to accuse me like that? You have all the wrong information, and you know you're full of blah 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 blah, and you don't know what you're talking about." And go to and you know, then here's this opportunity that I could use for purification, but instead I'm creating more negative karma. Okay, so that's why Aryadeva says the ignorant and unwise do not want to purify themselves. Of course, it's not that they really don't want to purify. Of course they want to purify themselves. But the way we act when we respond to anger with anger, when we respond to insult with insult, when we respond to beating with beating, when we respond to harsh words with harsh words, it's as if, you know, we don't want to purify our negative karma. It's as if, you know, when Rinpoche made the comment that sentient beings are running towards suffering, it's as if we're running towards suffering. Yeah? In defense of my holy ego. Yeah? My holy beloved I that does not exist in the way I cling to it, in the way I grasp it. You know? So in the, in the defense of something that doesn't even exist, the truly existent self, I create so much negative karma. Stupid? Yes. Yeah? Is this what sentient beings do? Yes. Yeah? Is this why we circle in samsara? Yes. Okay. Okay. So then the next verse is the inappropriateness of anger. So it's inappropriate to be angry, because unpleasant words are designated as harmful by oneself and are not inherently harmful. Okay, so verse 141, though unpleasant to hear, they are not intrinsically harmful. Thus thinking what comes from preconception, thus thinking what comes from preconception comes from elsewhere is fantasy. Okay, so although unpleasant words are, although certain words are unpleasant to hear, yeah, it's not because they are inherently unpleasant. It's because our mind has described the situation to ourselves in a certain way, you know, through the veil of our self-grasping, through the veil of our self-centeredness, and made a story out of what these words mean, and then gotten very upset because these words are so unpleasant and so painful. Okay? So, you know, somebody you're really close to says, "I hate you, I don't want to see you anymore." You know? And then we just get like, my world's ending. You know, Aryadeva says that these things, such remarks are not intrinsically harmful. Because if those words were intrinsically harmful, then everybody who heard them would experience the same degree of pain as we do. Even the person who said them would experience pain. Because if something is inherently harmful, it harms everybody. Yeah? But why do those words harm me and not somebody else? Because I'm looking at those words through the perspective of me. If somebody said to my friend, "I hate you, I don't want to see you again," I wouldn't get angry and depressed and defensive and feel like a victim. Yeah? And I would even tell my friend, you know, "Don't worry about it. This person is just upset. That's why they're saying that. You know, don't take it personally. They're actually saying more about themselves than they are about you." But when that same person says that to me, oh boy, you know, I freak out. Okay? So there you can see it's really due to misconception on my part if I freak out. Because there's nothing in and of those words that are inherently unpleasant. Because if there were, everybody would react the same way. Yeah. And also, I can see, it's very interesting, if somebody you don't like says, I hate you and don't want to see you again, you say, oh, good. If somebody you like says, I hate you and don't want to see you again, then you get upset. So you can see there's nothing in the words themselves. It's completely dependent on the situation and on the meaning that we give to it. Isn't it? Yeah? Okay. So the damage that's done by anger comes from our own preconception that we've been insulted, we've been rejected, we've been abandoned, we've been mistreated. You know, who's saying that? I'm saying that. I'm rejected, abandoned, unappreciated, mistreated, stamped on, taken for granted and unloved. I mean, that's what I'm telling myself, right? Yeah, who's creating that story? Yeah, I'm creating that story. Nobody else is creating that story, and that story does not exist outside as some kind of objective circumstance. Yeah, because if it did, everybody would see it exactly the same way, because it would be inherently existent. But everybody sees every circumstance completely differently. So the thing is, you know, to really wake up and see how we're creating our own reality. And once we realize that, we realize, you know, we can create a different reality. Instead of creating the poor me, nobody loves me, I'm mistreated and rejected and full of shame and unworthy. And instead of creating that reality, we create the reality of, you know, I have the basic dharmakaya. And I have a precious human life. And I have all the conditions for practicing. And I have a community and a teacher. And my health is good. And my mind is clear. And I can do so much. Wow! My life is incredible. And it's the exact same person. You can look at your life either of those ways. You know, and it's our choice. It's our choice. Because it's not inherently existent out there. Okay, so he says from thinking that what comes from preconception, so from thinking that our story is true, comes from elsewhere, that in other words, our story exists out there, and the problems come from other people and the external situation. He says, thus thinking that what comes from preconception comes from elsewhere is fantasy. He tells us straight. It's fantasy. Okay? So it's fantasy if I think my pain comes from other people. Yeah? But it's really my own ideas and my own self-grasping that has done me harm. Okay? Now you might say, well, what about in an extreme circumstance? Like, you know, they arrest you and imprison you and torture you and you didn't do anything. You know, shouldn't you get angry in that situation? Isn't that right legitimate anger? No, because what they're doing is completely illegal and you didn't do anything and they're torturing you. Yeah. But again, even with that, somebody who knows how to practice will see that if I get angry, it's because I'm grasping at self. Yeah? And because I'm holding on to self-centeredness. And I saying, you know, nobody can treat me like that. And this isn't fair. you know, and so we're angry because of that. Whereas, you know, it's possible to be in that kind of situation and still not be angry at the people who are imprisoning you or torturing you, if you know how to practice. Okay? So like His Holiness tells the story of one monk who was imprisoned in Tibet, and when he got out, he left Tibet and he came to Dharamsala. And His Holiness, you know, usually grants audiences to the people who have escaped. And so he was seeing this monk, and he asked the monk, you know, what were you most afraid of when you were incarcerated by the communists? And this monk said, I was afraid of losing my compassion for the people who were imprisoning me. Isn't that amazing? Yeah? I mean, that just floors me. So his whole time he's in prison, you know, he's creating compassion for the people who are imprisoning him, because he's seeing how confused their minds are, how most of the PLA soldiers were a bunch of, you know, young boys who were just trying to make some money for their families in very poor villages, and so join the army. And they had no awareness of karma and how much negative karma they're creating and what they're going to experience in the future due to their present actions. So this monk was cultivating compassion for them. Yeah. So, you know, if he's cultivating compassion for them, he's certainly not going to be angry. Pretty amazing. So, you know, if you know the Dharma well and you've practiced well, even horrible circumstances like this can be turned around in your mind. Okay, so it's when it's our own ideas which have created the misery by how we're thinking, then it's really unreasonable to be mad at other people. And when it's our own karma that's created the situation we're in, it's very unreasonable to be mad at other people. Okay? So they gave an example. Yeah. So it's like a herdswoman hearing somebody eating in the dark. And she thinks that, you know, because her husband has more than one wife, so she thinks the person eating in the dark is the child of the junior wife. And so she says, "What are you eating, you cow?" You know, when she hears this person eating in the dark. But when she turns on the light and she recognizes that it's actually her own daughter and not the child of the junior wife, then she says, "Oh, my pet, please have something to eat." Good example, isn't it? Yeah? Completely created by the mind. Okay, then the next verse is advice to punish the abuser in treatises on social conventions is wrong. So in ancient India, they wrote all these social treatises about how people should act. And one of the advice in those is that when somebody is abusing other people, they should be punished. Okay? So Joe Blow says, social treatises state that the abusive should be punished. We also think that way, don't we? Yeah? People who are abusive, people who are damaging, people who harm others. Yeah, people who break the law, they should be punished. Yeah. That's what most of us think. Okay? Aryadeva says, just as it plainly says the abuser should be punished, likewise, why should one who speaks pleasantly not be rewarded? In other words, that these social treatises say that, abusers should be punished. So in that case, people who speak and act nicely should be rewarded by the government or by the king. Are they? No. Okay. So, in other words, what these treatises are saying is quite misleading and biased, so don't pay attention to them. Okay, but we have that viewpoint very strong in American society, don't we? You know, somebody harms somebody else, we got to punish him. Yeah, and sometimes we justify the punishment as if we punish someone, that will make them change. Yeah, but when somebody has nothing and you take something away from them, it doesn't really motivate them to change at all. Okay? And then people think, well, you know, that, okay, if so one reason is we punish them so that they'll change, but that doesn't necessarily work. You know, maybe once in a while somebody will change because they get punished. But, you know, most people who commit crimes, before they commit the crime, they don't think, oh, if I do this action, I could wind up in prison for the rest of my life. You know, they're not thinking like that. They're completely caught up in the moment. So it doesn't really matter how strict you make the laws. People don't think about them, you know, when they're in the heat of the moment and having a strong, you know, emotion. And so that's for, like, crimes, you know, done with, like, explosive emotion. But then what about white-collar crimes that are so often done with, you know, meticulous planning? Yeah? Not out of some explosive emotion, but with meticulous planning. You know, how am I going to embezzle this? How am I going to rob people of something and make them think that it's their fault? Yeah. How am I going to keep collecting my big bonuses at the expense of the ordinary citizens? Yeah? So, they're not. I mean, those people actually know the punishments that could happen. But I think with them, again, the punishment doesn't deter them because they feel like they're beyond it. You know, I'm this kind of social level or I have this kind of occupation or whatever it is, that, you know, that law doesn't apply to me. And I can, you know, wiggle out of it some way or another. And often they do. Yeah, so it's quite interesting, isn't it? You know, I mean, how much do punishments really deter people from from doing things? I don't know. Now, does that mean, I'm going off on a tangent here, but does that mean that there's no penalties at all? That you don't have any laws at all and you say just do what you want, well, you're not going to, there's no consequence in society? No, you can't do that because that's going to create anarchy and chaos. Yeah, but you have to change your mind. And if somebody's doing something that is damaging to society or damaging other people, you may have to confine them. But you do it not to punish them and not to get even, but to protect other people and to protect that person themselves from creating horrible negative karma. Because remember that the person who harms others is actually harming themselves worse because they have to experience the result of their own destructive karma. Yeah. So out of compassion, you might have to incarcerate somebody. But that's quite different than incarcerating them because you hate them and you want to punish them and make them suffer. Okay? Okay, then then verse 143, okay, speaks about the inappropriateness of anger at those who make others aware of one's faults. So it's not appropriate to be angry at the people who tell others all of your own bad qualities. Do you think that's serious? Really? That you shouldn't get angry at people who blabber all your mistakes and your faults to everybody else? Of course I should get mad at them. I'm entitled to get mad at them. I need to stop them because they're ruining my reputation. That's what we think, isn't it? Aryadeva is saying, no, that's inappropriate. So the verse is, if that for which you are reviled is known to others, though they are not told, and anger at the speaker is unreasonable, how much more so towards those who lie? Okay, in other words, if that for which you are reviled is known to others, though they are not told, in other words, people know your faults. People know your mistakes, right? I mean, most people know our faults. They know our mistakes. They're there in plain sight. Okay, so if those things for which we're getting reviled, other people already know, why are we getting mad when somebody talks about them? It's a good question, isn't it? Yeah? So we think, you know, Joe Blow says, anger is unreasonable because being insulted reveals one's faults to others. But actually, most of the time, other people already know our faults. They're not learning anything new when somebody criticizes us publicly. So what's the purpose of getting angry if our faults are already known? Okay. And he says, and anger at the speaker is unreasonable. Okay, so it's unreasonable to get mad at the person who tells your faults because other people already know them. Then how much more so towards people who lie? So people who lie and accuse you of doing something that you didn't do, then it's even more unreasonable to get angry at them. Isn't it? If it's unreasonable to get angry at people who tell the truth and reveal your mistakes, even though people already know them, then it's even more stupid to get mad at people who accuse you of doing things you and having faults that you don't even have, because they aren't even there. Okay? So it's like, I like this example. Somebody taught this to me when I was in college. It's a very good example. It's like somebody says you have a nose on your face. You know? If somebody says, you know, I gave you this responsibility and you didn't fulfill it, or, you know, I trusted you and you blabbered my private things all over the place to other people, or, you know, I gave you something and now you're refusing to give it back to me. And so somebody criticizes us. Everybody knows it already. So it's like them saying you have a nose on your face. Yeah. If somebody says you have a nose on your face, do you get mad at them? No, because everybody knows you have a nose on your face. You don't go, no, I don't. It's like if somebody, you know, says you blew this job, you revealed my secrets, you did blah, 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 you're dishonest, and everybody knows it already. What use is denying it? It's like saying, no, I don't have any nose on my face. What are you talking about? There's no nose here. It's ridiculous. Okay? Then, getting angry at somebody who accuses you for something you didn't do is even more stupid, because that's like somebody saying, you have horns on your head. Yeah? It's like, no, there's no horns on my head. This person who's saying I have horns on my head has wrong information. Yeah, this is easily correctable by giving out the right information. So I don't need to get angry. Okay. So either way you look at it, whether somebody's telling the truth or somebody's lying, anyway, whatever they say about us, getting angry doesn't make any sense. Now, do you think you can think about that next time you hear some unpleasant words? Yeah? Does this argument make sense to you now? It does. It makes perfect sense. Do you think it'll make sense to you when somebody says you're a big idiot? No,
How dare they call me an idiot? They can't say that about me. I'm not an idiot. They're ruining my reputation. But, you know, just think about it. It is really silly to get mad. Huh? Okay. So he's saying, thus anger is always inappropriate. So it's wrong for a king to punish somebody who calls the blind blind, and it's also wrong for them to punish somebody who calls those who are not blind blind. Okay? So it's wrong to get angry at somebody who calls a jerk, as well as somebody who, you know, says somebody who isn't a jerk is a jerk. Unless it's somebody who's really an inherently existent jerk. And we want to make sure the whole world knows that. But that is never me. Yeah. It's never me. I am never a jerk. Never. Okay. Interesting, isn't it? Okay. So we have time for a couple of questions. We didn't get very far today, but maybe it gives you something to think about. Anything? Okay.
Well, I only wanted to mention that I could only go to this point why compassion is part of purification. So that makes it more clear that, for example, the prison situation of this monk that he would have not use the opportunity to purify his karma if he would get angry. So I couldn't get to
this. It's hard to think about, you know, when we're experiencing suffering, to just say, this is consuming my negative karma.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no sense in getting angry about it. Yeah. That doesn't mean you don't act to eliminate your suffering. Of course you can act to eliminate your suffering. It doesn't mean you let people take advantage of you and abuse you. You can still act to stop these things. But the point is you don't have to get angry to do it.
Can you use the term clinging attachment? So what's the difference just between vital attachment and clinging attachment?
Oh, to me, I was just using clinging attachment because it's the same as when I say regular attachment, but just because sometimes in the West, like people who have in psychology, they talk about like the kind of attachment formed when a child bonds with a parent. With, you know, the baby with the mother, with the father, they call that attachment. And I don't want people to think that the Buddha is saying that that is something negative. Yeah, so it's just a certain way we're using the word attachment in the Dharma.
So when a bad thing happens and you think, okay, this is an opportunity for me to purify my negative karma. Do you just think that? Or is there something you can do actively in order to make that happen?
In order to make what happen?
Purification.
Okay. Just
in response to it.
Right. No, it's your attitude that makes it purification.
That's it.
That's it. Because if you respond with anger, you're continuing your cyclic existence. If you respond without anger and just accept that this is a result of my own karma, you stop. You stop it right there. Yeah? You're not creating more cause for suffering. And, you know, that karma, you know, is getting exhausted. And plus, you know, if you really think about it seriously, you could be purifying. It could be that not just the result of that karma is getting purified, but it could be that there's other karmas that are getting consumed in the process too because of the way you're handling the situation. Okay? Okay. In other words, for example, that particular karma that is ripening in your pain right now, perhaps it could have ripened and you're having a really horrible rebirth for a long time. So you think, oh, this karma's ripening and just this pain right now in this life instead of for a long time is a bad rebirth? That's okay. I can handle this. I'm getting off easy. And then that really makes it purification. You know, because your mind has great confidence and faith in the law of karma and its effects. And you're willingly accepting, you know, that without getting angry, without getting depressed.
So there's a lot to think about. There's a lot to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in contrast to just simply not getting angry.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can not get angry and not think about anything.
Right, that's true. Yeah. So you could just not get angry and just brush it off. Yeah. Or you know, and maybe it could be because you've already done a lot of training, so you're not so ego-sensitive to start with. Yeah? And so, you know, it just isn't something that grabs your ego to start with because you've been trained, you've trained your mind so well. Or if it's something that, you know, could potentially grab your mind, you're really counteracting that possibility by immediately changing the way you think. So practice, you know, even just with the small things, little inconveniences. Yeah? Practice with those and just think, oh, you know, result of my own negative karma. Or this could have ripened as something really big. Mm-hmm. Or it's just my own preconception, you know, thinking I'm so important that nothing should inconvenience me. Yeah. And so, you know, apply the Dharma antidote. So just start with small things in your life. These happen all the time, don't they? Yeah. I mean, I noticed there's a whole new supply of earplugs down. I mean, you guys must be going through earplugs like I'll get out, you know. But yeah, but instead of getting angry at, you know, because somebody rolls over, or somebody snores, or somebody does something, you just say, you know, it is what it is, and I don't need to get mad about it. Yeah. You can still use the earplug.
I can see a potential trap.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I've got a headache. Does it purify? So therefore, I shouldn't take ibuprofen.
No, I didn't say that, did I?
But I can see how that's a potential trap you could fall into with this.
Yeah, but I deliberately said that doesn't mean you know, don't take action to eliminate your suffering. Yeah, you can still take action, sure.
How about when someone criticizes me, should I put earplugs in?
Yeah.
We're in silence.
Okay. Yeah.
I never really understood when you said when you react with anger, then you give the power to the person because the anger.
Okay. So how are you giving your power to the other person when you get angry? Because you're saying, by what you do, you have the power to make me angry. And when you do that, I have no choice but to be angry. That means I am powerless. I have no choice. Okay? I have no choice because I've said I get angry because of what that person's doing, which means that I can't be peaceful unless that person changes, which means I'm giving away my power. Okay? You get it?
About in a reverse situation where someone tells you, oh, you're making me so angry, like in a work situation or a living situation. So, and then I've done this in the past and made the mistake of saying, hey, I didn't make you angry, man. You're deciding to be angry. And then,
yeah. No, this is a technique you use for yourself as an advocate. Yeah? With other people. Then you say, you know, oh, I understand you're upset. What is it you need? You know, you act in a sympathetic way. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of Lobsang's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Hidam Guranda Mandala Kamniryatayami.
Due to this merit,
may we soon attain the awakened state of Timrisi, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness. Powerful Tenzin Gyatso Chenrezig, may you stay until samsara ends.
May the deeds
of explaining and practicing the Dharma done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising and nonviolent actions in the 10 directions, and especially Ashravasti Abbey in the west flourish.